You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius. If you want to get completely nerdy on this one, let's have a nerdy conversation.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, same old Sean. This week, we have a talk with Dan Charnas. Dan is the author of the definitive history of hip-hop business, The Big Payback. In addition to that, he's had a fascinating career as a journalist, one of the first writers for The Source, a record exec working for, among others, Rick Rubin's American Records, and a comedy writer for MTV's Lyricist Lounge show, among others. We talked to Dan about the history of hip-hop and business and where the two intersect. As always on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, we have a special kind of audio footnote. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius.
Go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL64. There, you'll find audio, video, and more information to bring you further outside the lines. And now, here's our talk with Dan Charnas, author of The Big Payback. Welcome to Outside the Lens with Rap Genius.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Good to be here.
I'm Sean. I'm here with Dan Charnas. Huge career we'll get into in detail, but most importantly, author of a great book called The Big Payback, the definitive history of hip-hop business.
Indeed.
Yeah. Read the book. I really loved it. But just so our listeners can get situated, can you give sort of a short history of yourself and your history in hip hop business before you wrote the book?
Sure. I started in the business in the mailroom, working in the mailroom of a small independent record company called Profile Records, which was one of the first independent labels to completely dedicate itself mostly dedicate itself to hip hop. It was the label that signed Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, Run DMC, Rob Bass, Special Ed, Dana Dane, and so forth. So I started in the mailroom and I worked my way up, through the ranks there, while writing for a newsletter about hip hop from Boston called The Source. Around that time, The Source moved to New York, so I wrote some of their first cover stories, and then was hired by Rick Rubin to go run his rap department, which was really just me, out in Los Angeles. So I was in L.A. I worked for him in L.A. for 7 years. Sir Mix-a-Lot's Baby Got Back was the first record that we had together. I signed, well-thought-of underground hip-hop acts like Chino XL and Quest the Mad Lad. DJ Kool's Let Me Clear My Throat was another song I was involved with bringing to the label. After that, I ran Forrest Whitaker's nascent record label through Epic for a couple of years. Then I... Is this entirely too much history?
No, that's great.
Okay.
It's great.
Not used to talking about myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after that, I started writing comedy for TV. So I wrote for a show on MTV called The Lyricist Lounge Show. And wrote for Comic U for BET for a while. And then decided at some point that I really was homesick and I wanted to come back to New York. And I wanted to... start writing nonfiction and, really reclaim what I was, when I left New York as a journalist. So that was sort of the roots of what then became The Big Payback.
Nice. And I mean, there's so much even in that to you know, dig into before we even get to the book. But first and most important of all, any good Dice Clay stories?
Wow. You know, one thing that we did do with Dice that actually I did with Mark Dedia, who was the general manager of Deaf American Recordings, is that we knew that there was a real kind of cultural love fest going on between Dice and a lot of folks in hip-hop who love Dice, you know, for the fact that he was audacious, you know, gangster of comedy, so to speak. So what we did was we created an entire piece of vinyl of little bits and sound bites from Dice that, you know, basically DJs could scratch in. And I think I might have a few of those left somewhere in storage. But, you know, that was really cool for us because we were able at Deaf American to make those connections that weren't being made culturally at other places. Dice himself, you know, I only shook his hand once. I got better Black Crow stories, but...
Yeah, that was in the book. You talk about how Rick wanted nothing to do with them until they blew, and then all of a sudden he was happy to tell everyone that he had worked with them.
Yeah, you know, folks around me, my friends who, you know, our mutual friends used to joke that Rick, you know, basically striped his name onto the album after it blew up, which is, hey, man, it's his prerogative. And I think Rick would probably tell you himself. He's like, yes, I did. Or something like they forgot to put my name in there.
Right, right.
Which, of course, you know, I don't think he, you know, it was no secret he wasn't a big fan of the Black Crowes when George signed them, but he was a friend to George, and what he wanted to do most of all was to be a friend to George and to let George sign the act that he loved that he wasn't able to sign at A&M, which was Mr. Crow's Garden.
Right.
So he said, you just got to change that name.
Yeah. This is the guy, George, by the way, is the guy who I think Beastie Boys fans know as the guy who sold a hot dog, right? George Drakoulias.
George Drakoulias, in the song, primarily because his name rhymes with Orange Julius.
Right. Yes.
George was Def Jam employee number one, for folks who want to go way, way back, working in the dorm with Rick, and he played a big role in, you know, some of those early rock records that Rick produced, and then went on to become an A&R guy at A&M and found Black Crowes. And now George is he's a pretty big music supervisor for a lot of films. Like you can see, I think he has a close relationship with Wes Anderson and those folks because, I don't know, one of the films that they were showing, like, I think it was... oh God, what was the name of the movie about the Jacques Cousteau-like dude? Anyway,
what was that called? Steve Zissou or something?
Yeah, Zissou or whatever.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
One of the films that they show in that has a sort of mock documentaries that they show within the film. Yeah. It says it's an Osiri Drakoulias production. So yeah, it's just a fun name to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a fun guy. He's a great guy. We actually shared an office at Deaf American when I first moved to LA, but he would never show up. So, and he had all his demos. So I told him that every day he didn't show up, I would make the size of his area a little bit smaller. So I taped it off, and every day I would move the tape and the boxes into a corner until finally I moved all the boxes into the storage and took the office for myself. Thanks, George.
That's amazing. And let me clear my throat. It seems like that record has just kind of like always been around.
Always.
It's like always something you hear on the radio.
Hey,
like,
brother, that record was around even before it was around. It was called the 900 number by DJ Mark the 45 King. But that record actually was Deaf American, or it was American by then, American's first piece of... what is now affectionately called research A&R, which is really the only kind of A&R that anybody does. Basically, instead of going to a club and finding a new artist, it was looking at what's happening locally on the charts in other places of the country and snatching up properties, basically. So Rick had hired a guy named Dino Paredes from, I think he was working at Priority before that, and Dino and his assistant Sam Wick, they zeroed in on this record, and then, you know, we went out to Baltimore and met Steve at CLR Records and, you know, vibed with Cool a little bit and signed it.
Yeah.
Which was cool because my parents lived in Baltimore, so I got to fly back and see them from LA.
And it's such a weird record in that, like, it's not a song exactly, right? It's just kind of like...
It would be called a rap or a chat, I suppose, if we were in Jamaica. But,
right.
It was... I mean, it was very hip-hop in the sense that that's what hip-hop was. I mean, what DJ Kool was embodying was rhyming over somebody else's record.
Yeah.
That's it. So what's more hip-hop than that?
Rap
yeah, piece. And that gets back to the into your book, the very beginnings of it. DJ Hollywood's a really important figure
in it.
But he never really, at least until he was sort of past his prime, made any records.
Yeah, well, because he wasn't interested in it.
Yeah.
Because nobody, you know, especially him, you know, folks like him and Eddie Chiba weren't really interested in making records. They were making much more money working the party scene. And who would want to make a record of somebody talking over a record?
Right.
You know, it was a leap that they couldn't make. And then when other folks had made the leap, it was too late for them. And you also have to have, you know, or for longevity in hip hop, you had to make that other conceptual leap in that I'm not just rocking over a beat. I'm actually writing a song, you know, that's going to have a focus point, like a chorus. And, but I did, one of the things I wanted to do in the book is redeem DJ Hollywood a little bit because he gets left out of a lot of major narratives on hip hop. And the fact is that hip hop is not just one thing. Because we've named it hip hop, that's why Kool Herc gets the credit for being the father of hip hop. But, the fact is there were always two strains of this phenomenon that was going on. There was the stuff in the Bronx that was break based and people rhyming over breaks and you know the break pantheon expanded with Afrika Bambaataa and Flash added that sort of virtuosity. And that became what was named hip hop. But there was always this other thing that worked right alongside it, which was the more adult thing, which was the club. Like club rap, for lack of a better term. They didn't call it hip-hop. I mean, they didn't even call it rap. It was just guys like DJ Hollywood and Chiba and Starsky who catered to a more adult crowd who went to clubs and rhymed over disco records, not breaks, you know, not the rock records and stuff like that, not James Brown. And that was just as valid. As a matter of fact, a lot of those guys in the hip-hop scene wanted to be, would have given their eye teeth cliche, yeah, to be, you know, a Hollywood or a Chiba, because those were the guys that made a lot of money. And one of the points of the book was to say, hey, you have these two strains of hip-hop. You had the sort of Harlem-based club older thing, and then the kid stuff in the Bronx, the hip-hop stuff. They've always been this sort of polar force in our music, and that in the mid-90s, you could still see that represented by Wu-Tang on one hand, sort of that Bronx break lineage, and then Puff and Uptown, the other, you know.
Who literally sampled a lot of the disco hits.
Sure, right. It makes a lot of sense. And I mean, there's a lot of crossover between those two, and there always was. But I guess the orthodoxy just bugs the shit out of me.
Sure. You know?
And so to say that one is more valid than the other is kind of silly and revisionist.
Yeah.
Rap Genius.
I feel like there's been this, between your book and then Roni Sarig's thing, there's been kind of this push to get, you know, DJs in the traditional, you know, in a sort of like the post-war Southern black DJs who were kind of like rapping in, you know, in a loose sense over records, had kind of like rhyming banter between the records.
And you mean like Jack Gibson?
Yeah, and like that kind of stuff. And then putting that as sort of a unsung forefather of hip hop, and then you have, you know, people doing the same thing in disco clubs,
yeah,
as a more direct lineage.
You know, I mean, if you want to get completely nerdy on this one, let's have a nerdy conversation. What I don't like, I went to a party once, and you know, was talking to a bunch of academics who I didn't know, and you know, they asked me what I did, and I said I write on hip hop. I said, "Oh yes, do you know so and so from the Lost Poets? Like, you know, they're hip." I was like, "I don't think we need to equate the influence of folks like the Lost Poets or
Last Poets. Yeah.
Jesus Christ, see, dumbass. Sorry, dude. I am now evicted from this nerd conversation." It's really early in the morning, too, though. So I don't think we need to. We can say that, like, Jockey Jack Gibson and Last Poets are like the major influences on hip hop, but that's right. Not the same as saying that they are, right?
Right.
I would never say Frankie Crocker was the, you know, the founding father of rap in some way, even though he had a tremendous influence on everybody who was emceeing at that time.
Yeah.
I feel like we need to really acknowledge where a lot of this stuff comes from. At the same time, hip hop still is, you know, what it is. It happened in New York.
Yeah, definitely. And one of probably the most important label of the sort of like post old school period, post kind of 70s period, is Def Jam. You obviously write extensively about them in the book. One of the things that I thought was super interesting that like I'd thought about but hadn't really seen stated this clearly was you talk about it as a suburban label from like the owners to the artists.
Right. That's directly from Rick. Rick Rubin actually articulated it as a suburban label. You know, and it is and it isn't. I mean, I think, yeah, in the one sense, Russell was from an outer borough. Rick was definitely from a suburb. And they both had suburban integrationist sensibilities in that, you know, Russell had gone to school around white folks and Rick had gone to school with black kids. And that this was a world where things naturally mixed. That's what they wanted their world to be. So that's why Def Jam became so important to the growth of the music, not just the fact that Rick really zeroed in on the importance of the chorus. I think Russell, too. Russell had an innate sense of that as well. But also that they really understood packaging, and they understood that this was, I mean, Def Jam really was the first rap label that was made by and for, you know, rap fans.
Yeah. And they put out probably the two most important early rap albums, right? The first Run DMC and then LL's first record.
Well, not Run DMC. That was Profile.
That was Profile. Yeah. Sorry, of course. You were, you know, you're
all right, so we are even on the early morning mistakes.
Exactly. But that's a common thing, right? Every, you know, I've certainly made that mistake before. I know lots of people sort of associate Run DMC and Def Jam, even though they weren't on Def Jam.
Yes, well, they very much, you know, and that drove Corey Robbins absolutely bananas, is that people would continually say that, you know, Run DMC was a Def Jam artist. And he's like, it's profile, even today, you know?
Right. Crazy. Obviously, yeah, because, you know, it's his, you know, his brother's his manager. And, you know, what was the relationship between Rush Management and Def Jam?
They were two separate entities whose finances were sloppily commingled until, I believe, Bill Stefani started to try to unmingle them, and then Carmen Ashurst came in and really put the hammer down.
Yeah. And jumping back in time a little bit, I was surprised to find that, like, you know, gangsters in the hip-hop business world didn't just jump in sometime in the 1990s, that it was around from the very beginning.
Oh.
I was wondering if you could talk about Morris Levy and Rapper's Delight.
You know, gangster, listen, I mean, the whole point of the book is that none of this stuff that is put onto hip-hop, any of it, anything you can say about hip-hop, happened in other genres, right? So, you know, you want to talk about people lamenting today that, oh, you know, hip-hop is just, you know, it's been taken over by basically this, I don't know, Southern ethos, and then, you know, it's basically strip club music, and it's like, what do you think jazz was, man? Jazz was invented in the brothels of New Orleans, right? So nothing's changed. It's just, we, you know, there was a period where hip hop had very highfalutin political aspirations and political impact. But it's always been, you know, high and low, if you know what I mean. But to answer your question more directly, and now I've forgotten your question.
I was about Morris Levy.
Right, yeah, gangsters. So yeah, gangsters have always been a part of the American entertainment business from time immemorial. You know, the early jazz artists, whether it be Duke or Louis Armstrong, they were handled by some unscrupulous characters, and it continued in hip-hop. I mean, Raymond Chandler, you know, he was, I guess, a guy who four-walled the first parties for Flash in the Bronx and, you know, was a tough character. Gene Griffin was the guy who ended up bringing Teddy Riley to the fore, and Gene Griffin was a guy that you didn't want to mess with. Joe Robinson, you know, a guy maybe who claimed to have more connections than he actually did, but was very much partnered with Morris Levy, who was a gangster of the R&B tradition before then. And it continued. I think one of the points I tried to make in The Big Payback is that bullies go away. Like, Suge Knight had a fearful reign, but it was relatively brief, because no dude like that is going to keep his empire locked down by force. You know,
whereas,
this is not going to happen.
Whereas Russell Simmons is kind of a through line in your book, just sort of by the sheer force of his personality and his vision that even he doesn't seem to fully understand at first.
Right, right. Because he really is. I mean, say what you want about Russell, about his scatteredness or whatever, but Russell, you know, was the person who fought for the integrity of the music and never felt he had to resort to any kind of violence or threats or be a, you know, thuggish, you know, to do what he needed to do. I mean, and you know, say what you want about Lior, but Lior's the same way. Lior never picked up a gun. You know, I mean, and actually, you know, Def Jam was a breeding ground for people who, you know, when they want to come in out of that. You know, Chris Lighty had a rough upbringing. And was, you know, was a bit rough around the edges, but he came to Def Jam and worked with Lior because he was tired of all that, yeah. You know?
And he became so, just as a sidebar, I know I got to see exactly how important he was to his artists when I had the chance to talk pretty recently, you know, post his passing to Busta about him, and Busta just gushed, just opened up and you know, it was really incredible, and I got to see sort of firsthand the impact that Chris had on the lives of his artists.
Yeah, he was I almost didn't write about him in the book. I mean, if it hadn't been for Sophia Chang suggesting that I, you know, really talk to him, and if it hadn't been for Chris himself being so open, and then, you know, must give props to the Violators, you know, Chris Ali and Daryl, you know, especially who helped me out with the book. To enable me to paint a picture of a guy who was the personification of hip-hop's rise. He came from the Bronx just like hip-hop.
So interesting. So yesterday, in preparation for this, I scoured YouTube, and I found a 2020 piece from 1981.
That's right.
That you write about, and you write about its importance. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about Rapping to the Beat.
Which is only on the web, because I put it there. Because it was not on the web, and I got that video from Danny Schechter. But
you got it directly from the researcher.
Yeah, man.
Wow.
Yeah, Danny was fantastic. A great, great. That guy is an American. You know, that guy is a real American. I mean, he did America a great service with that, and continued. You know, he was involved, as you know from the book. He was the guy involved with desegregating the Buddy Dean show in Baltimore, the event on which the movie Hairspray is based. So Danny, you know, researched that show with the help of Bill Adler and got it on 2020. And it was a seminal, you know, one of hip-hop's seminal moments in American culture. It was the first time that people really got a decent journalistic look on a national level at what the subculture at the time was.
Yeah, I mean, the crazy thing about the piece is how good it is, surprisingly. I mean, you can say like, oh, the anchor has funny hair, you know, or whatever. Yeah, but
you
like,
you know what? It's Danny Schechter and Bill Hadler.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, you look, you know, there was this documentary recently on VH1 called The Tanning of America. And, you know, Bill and I were interviewed for that. And just watching Bill, you know,
yeah.
30 years, 35 years, however many years later it is, just like, wow, you know, thank God we have this dude helping to shape the narrative of what this thing is.
Yeah.
He did it great then, and he's doing it great now.
Yeah, obviously Bill is a huge friend of the show, yeah. And we're you know, happy to have him. Jumping ahead a little bit, about 93-ish, right, you write about how, like, there was, you know, this sort of political element in hip-hop, a sort of, you know, black nationalists, mm-hmm. like, you sort of use the word righteous as kind of a stand-in for this trend in the music. And you say that was replaced by people searching for the real, you know, sort of authentic, which got conflated with street and whatever. I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that shift.
Or the rich. You know, there's a saying, you know, would you rather be right or would you rather be rich? And I think in hip-hop, you know, for the golden age was defined by being right, you know, by being righteous. And then with the advent of a few key, very good albums, things started to turn to being real, which is a little different than being right, and being rich. You know, which we know, like, you know, so that was the bad boy thing. Being real, as a matter of fact, think of it this way, it was the dichotomy. Being real was the pretense of Death Row, right? And being rich was the pretense of Bad Boy. And that came out of after a golden era where, you know, folks just wanted to be right. But there was this little sort of, what would you call it, a little buffer area in that transition. And I think that Cypress Hill's first album and Dre's first solo album, The Chronic, were really key points in that transition. They are great, great albums. But what they did, you know, Cypress was political, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, you know, shit's fucked up. Let's go smoke some weed. I mean, that weeded period between 91 and 93 was sort of the gateway drug. To what then became, you know, keeping it real, which more often than not didn't keep it real, right? It was people playing it being real, and also people playing it being rich, and then, of course, you know, being rich.
Right, some of them actually became rich.
Some of them actually became rich.
Yeah. Rap Genius.
So it was a sad development, I think, for me, because I really liked hip-hop in its righteous phase. But even the righteousness had its pretense, right? You know, Public Enemy came out, and, you know, they had their strengths and their weaknesses, and then you had the copy groups like X-Clan, which had their strengths and their weaknesses. But what I missed in all of that, those later years, is that you really couldn't come out with, it wasn't as diverse anymore. Like, hip-hop lost its biodiversity after it became a place of real economic opportunity and, you know, cashing in. So you lost comedy rap. You lost a lot of the, you know, great female MCs. You lost, you know, even sort of the intergenre stuff, like the jazzy rap kind of, you know, things that sort of left hip-hop and went somewhere else. But it was hard, like, you know, with Quest the Mad Lad, it was really heartbreaking because he was a guy who was really, really talented. But hip-hop had no space for somebody like him.
Yeah, the narrowing. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, the kind of narrowing of what could be mainstream, sort of post, largely, so you're saying post The Chronic or whatever.
Yeah.
Is that kind of a mainstream?
And
the kicker is the records, obviously, on their own merits, the Cypress record and the Dre record especially, were great.
Fantastic records.
Yeah.
And political, too. But like I said, the emphasis was more on the culture around those records was not a political culture. The culture around those records was, you know, fuck it, let's get high.
Right. So Where in all of this did you decide I'm going to write about hip hop business? And sort of, and I'm also curious about like the responses you got, because I definitely like, I know I personally put off reading the book for a little while just out of some sort of reflexive anti-corporate, well, if it's about business, it's not really about, you know, the important things in hip hop or whatever.
Right. Right.
And I'm sure you've gotten that from lots of people.
I haven't actually as much as I thought I would.
Interesting.
You know, my intro to the book is very defensive.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I know some of y'all are not going to like this. Let me explain to you why I'm doing this.
Yeah.
How it started really was as a magazine idea, pitch for a magazine article. James Bernard and Reggie Dennis, who were the editor-in-chief and music editor, respectively, of The Source, left The Source in 1994 after that big editorial walkout.
Yeah. Right.
Then they co-founded, at Harris Publications, they co-founded XXL magazine. And they left XXL over disagreement over, you know, whether they were going to get equity in the magazine or not. And they went to go found another magazine called Manifest. So in the early stages of that, I proposed a piece called Last Night a DJ Saved My Business, which was just going to be about the irony. I wanted to probe those areas where, you know, black folks and white folks met in the business and the unintended, ironic and surprising results of that. Because I think the narrative of R&B that we inherited really is one of exploitation. Meaning, you know, you have Morris Levy coming in and he's this big cigar-chomping Jew and he's going to, you know, steal all the artist's money and buy him Cadillacs and keep all the royalties for himself. And I think when you listen to a lot of early hip-hop records, you get a lot of that same sort of feeling of, you know, record companies, man, fuck them. And, you know, and because I was a part of and witness to some of that, I saw that some of it was true. Some of it was very much not true. And I wanted to sort of pick apart the irony that the music that we extol the most, the De La Souls, Run DMCs, you know, the golden age of hip hop, Queen Latifah, these were all records that were produced by white ethnic, Irish, Jewish, Italian, you know, business people, not corporate. And very much not, and maybe while not you know, well-versed in African-American history and culture, you know, they couldn't tell you who, you know, Nat Turner was, but, you know, they did have some feel for the culture, real feel for the culture. I mean, you know, Tom Silverman went up to the Bronx to the T-Connection and hung out with Bambaataa. I mean, you know, not too many major label, you know, folks went up there to do that. Charles Koppelman wasn't up there, you know? So I wanted to get at that in a magazine piece that would talk about that era. And that magazine never got off the ground. I pitched it around a lot. Like, I had one editor basically turn his back on me in mid-pitch, you know, like in the late 2000s. It was just, like, humiliating. So I thought, well, you know what? Charnas, maybe better take a hint. Maybe this is part of a book. And the book was, you know, I think when Jeff Chang's Can't Stop, Won't Stop comes out, I think that's when it really crystallized for me. It's like, oh, so he's telling this cultural side of the story, but there's a whole part missing. Like, he skips over Run DMC. And for me, that's part and parcel of why, if you want to answer the question, why is hip-hop the way it is and why is it so big and how did it get from here to here, you have to tell that story. But you also have to tell a story of those people who helped bring it to the fore, the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know? And there's a lot of bad and ugly, but there's a lot of good, too. So that was the impetus to write The Big Payback and to make it as expansive as possible and to bite off way more than I could chew. And that was the beginning of a 4-year odyssey to complete the book.
Yeah. And it is a great book and it is completely expansive. I mean, and there's just so much in there. And I wanted to ask about one of the things you hinted at, about race and, you know, ethnicity and, hip hop business people. so many of the early important business people were white. A disproportionate number of them were Jewish. Mm-hmm. And so I was just curious about, you know, rather than like, what do you have to say about that? Because, you know, who, I mean, you know, whatever. Like, I was just curious about like the business of hip hop. How did it reflect and how did it avoid or transcend the racial inequities of, you know, America generally?
How did, I mean, it just, it did. I mean, hip hop was a creature of its circumstance and reflected its circumstance and then projected onto the circumstance. So it was, hip hop was a cultural creation of kids of color, you know, assisted minorly here and there by, you know, some enterprising, you know, white kids. When it moved to become a business, then other folks got involved. Then you would get the Corey Robbins, Tom Silvermans, Eddie O'Loughlin's, Dante Ross's, you know? And then, you know, kids like Adam Yawk, city kids like Adam Horovitz and Mike Diamond and Rick Rubin, you know, coming in from the suburbs. And so as it grows, it attracts all these different kinds of people and becomes a product of all of them. The thing that makes hip-hop unique for me is that R&B, like jazz before it, was able to, they were able to sort of strip black people and black ownership and sort of blackness away from R&B to the point where if you listen to Led Zeppelin, you might not have to think about black folks, even though it's very much the blues. And that is why, you know, forgive me, rednecks of all persuasions, you know, all over, you know, like, can listen to Led Zeppelin or Lynyrd Skynyrd and fly the Confederate flag and, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I grew up with those kids, right?
Yeah.
During the disco sucks era. So the thing about hip hop that made it different from that stuff, from rock, from R&B, from jazz, is that there was a certain, you couldn't divorce black people and black culture and black history and black equity from hip hop. It just wasn't going to happen because it was birthed in all those things. And in order to be what it was, it had to keep those things. So even the white folks who, you know, and not just white, but Asian and Latino, you know, the folks who were involved in hip hop, all, we all understood that this is a black thing culturally. And that to be in it, the price of being in it was kind of caring about that. And there were some who did and some who didn't, you know? But we understood it that way. Like we understood that this was part of a larger American project. And that's why hip hop had to succeed because, you know, we couldn't see the future. You know, we didn't know about or could have predicted somebody like Obama, but, you know, I definitely felt, and I know other folks beside me, whether it be John Schechter or James Bernard or, you know, or Reggie Dennis, you know, felt that this was a very important enterprise for the future of America and for this generation.
One of the themes of the book is the successes and failures of black-owned businesses within hip-hop.
Yeah.
Obviously, the rise and fall of Sugar Hill Records.
Mm-hmm.
But something that you mentioned that I hadn't even heard of was the West Coast distribution.
Yeah, I think Luke wanted to put together... Oh, no. First, it was the West Coast thing. You're talking about the thing that...
with Mercola, I think in line with Mercola Records.
Yeah, it was a competition for Mercola.
Yeah.
And I think it was, Atron Gregory and a few other folks, Egyptian Lover, and they got together and they put together a distribution thing. And then in a few years later, I know Suge and Luke were talking about doing something as well, so national sort of. Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, you a big part of the big payback is discussion of equity and how do you maintain equity as an artist, but also how do you maintain it as a community of people, you know? So can black folks who create most of the cultural capital in America retain that equity for that? And I, one way that the majors were able to become majors is through distribution. So what if there were to be a black-owned national distribution concern that could now begin to make money off of office cultural capital? So it was fascinating to me, that part of it.
That it was tried twice and didn't get off the ground.
Yeah, I mean, and frankly, you know, now we can see with hindsight that any box retail distribution system that was to be invented in the 90s would perish 10 years later.
Collapsed, yeah.
Right. So, you know, it. Listen, the saga of black capital in America is a bit of a sad one in the sense that it always seems to be a bit, you know, too late. And when black capital is successful, take Russell, take Jay-Z and, you know, their multi-hundred million dollar sales of their assets to larger corporations. You know, the sad thing is that the benefit of black capital is first and foremost to the black capitalist and not to the community. So it's something that perhaps the community can be proud of, but that wealth doesn't continue to benefit and never really did benefit the community. So it is a question that is for the ages and it is still unanswered, but it is very important because all of us now in this, you know, internet economy, this cyber economy, need to find some solid ground because the middle class is really, you know, is in jeopardy because of it.
Rap Genius.
And you hinted in the last answer about the sale of Def Jam, you know, circa like 1999,
yeah,
and what that did. Now, I'd heard Jay brag about on records, oh, my hit album, you know, made, you know, Def Jam's purchase price go up, right? I assumed that maybe there was some truth to it, but that a lot of it was sort of braggadocio. But you point out that he and DMX, having, you know, hit albums in 98, really did do that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no question that the successes of 1998, two DMX albums especially, really fed the fuel for this, you know, this buyout, which was already, I think, set contractually, you know, before this even happened. You know, it's the way the music industry goes. You know, you're cold one year and you're hot the next. And it's something that these corporations will never get that, because corporations want quarter over quarter growth. And they want growth every quarter. And we all know that healthy organisms need periods of rest, aka recession. You need to scale back to build up. If you never scale back, if you never have any fallow periods, you'll never have any growth. But, you know, and our, listen, our economy pays for it, our ecology pays for it.
Yeah.
We're getting deep here, son. Deep.
Definitely. And another sort of great, or at least very public, black capitalist is Brian Williams, baby from Cash Money.
Yes.
And I was so fascinated to hear you go in depth about Wendy Day, yeah, of the Rap Coalition and her early history with Cash Money.
Yeah.
So she's kind of vanished in a lot of ways in the public telling of the early years of Cash Money and of the deal that, you know, gave them autonomy and the whole nine. Why do you think she was written out? And second, you famously talk about how, like, Cash Money tried to stiff her and not pay her,
yeah,
her commission. And what do you, were you able to ascertain any kind of motivation for that other than they just didn't want to pay anyone they could get away with not paying?
Yeah. I'll tell you this. As an author, one of the things I was really cognizant of is who are my heroes in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't want to get into a situation where, you know, most of the heroes were white, like Wendy Day riding in and sort of saving hip-hop, right after you've seen Corey Robbins and Rick Rubin come in and save hip hop and all. Like, I really tried to be cognizant of who are my main characters, what's their gender, what's their race, and, you know. And at the same time, it's difficult to do because so much of the business is dominated by white males that you're just going to have them in your story. And then, so that's as an author. As a person, right, as a person who was a former executive in the music business, I had a very ambivalent relationship with Wendy Day prior to writing this book.
That's so interesting.
I would see Wendy, you know, pictures of Wendy, and she started this rap coalition, and there was a part, and I told Wendy this. I said, who is this strange white woman who thinks she can start a rap coalition? What right does she have? I mean, like, I had no more right, you know, to be doing what I'm doing, but, you know, it's that whole sort of blacker than thou thing that I think white
Dante calls it white on white crime.
White on white crime, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, so, you know, it was a little bit of hateration, but, and then the other part of it I didn't like was her demonization of record companies, because I thought, again, and it comes out in my book, that, you know, record companies do a lot of good, and artists, a lot of artists are schmucks, you know? Like, they're just horrible people. So you got horribleness on all sides, and you've got exploitation and get-overness on both sides. So I felt her, like, you know, sort of the record company rule 4080, you know, music industry rule 4080 was just not cool, you know, and didn't have much decorum. And then, you know, putting out Quest the Mad Lad on American was a very, very difficult thing for me personally, because I was surrounded by people who didn't believe in the project, and I sort of kind of was fighting, felt like I was fighting alone on that, and there wasn't a lot of resources that were, you know, enabled me to move forward with the project. And Quest was understandably very frustrated, and he went to Wendy to say, get me out of this, because that's what Wendy did, right? She got artists out of contracts. So I get this letter from Wendy, this very officious letter, you know, we think that Quest can be great. It's like somebody telling you, you know, your child, you know, you're not doing so well with your child. We know what, you know, we see a lot of potential in your child. Stop abusing your child. It felt like that. I mean, I don't equate Quest in any way to my child as a grown man, but it felt like that, right? So I literally had to swallow my pride and swallow my ego and reach out to her and say, look, I'm on, I know maybe Quest doesn't feel this way, but I'm on his side and I'm on your side. So whatever you can do to help, great. And so Wendy actually came back and helped. Like, she got Quest stuff that his manager, quote unquote manager, never got him. She got him on the road. She got him, you know, doing shows. And I was so grateful to Wendy, I fought to get her reimbursed for all that shit. You're not paying for that, Wendy. You know, let us pay for that. So we, you know, we worked together for a while, and that changed my view of, you know, what Wendy was. And then Wendy was changing her own conception of who she was at that time, from being a person who got artists off of labels to helping artists get better deals. And this was right around the time that she was working with Eminem. So when it came time to write the book, I knew I had to call Wendy. And even though she basically in some ways comes off as the white hero, you know, what the fuck? She is a white hero. She really is. Like, she really did do all that shit. She really did help Master P retain his equity and get that distribution deal with Priority. She really did help Eminem. She really did get Cash Money that deal. You know, she's a pivotal figure in that. And the irony, of course, this horrible for Wendy, but great for storytelling, is that the biggest deal she ever does, the one that she finally decides, okay, maybe I will try to get paid off of this, they stiff her. You know? They stiff her. So, and Wendy tells that story better than I do, you know, and Wendy told it great on the Tanning of America doc as well. And she, I count her as a friend now, and somebody who really deserves a tremendous amount of credit, not for being some business person, but for actually being a scholar, a white scholar of Afrocentrism. I mean, that's how she started. She started at Temple University studying this shit. She didn't come from nowhere like I thought she did. She actually came from somewhere. And that's great. And I love honoring that.
Yeah. Very, very cool. And one of the, you know, getting to one of the other sort of final big themes in the book, you spend a lot of time talking about Ice-T and body count and cop killer and the response to it. And, you know, rather than rehash what happened with it, which obviously people can read or, you know, maybe some remember, I know, I was curious about looking, you know, in the years after it and even through today, what you think the lasting effects of the cop killer controversy are?
Lasting effects. Wow. Well, let me start my brain by saying the short-term effects were that a lot of the political hip-hop was silenced along with some of the gangster stuff. And so that blunted a lot of the post-riot response, right? What it also did was it chased hip-hop away from places that I thought would have taken a little better care of it, you know? It chased it into the hands of Jimmy Iovine and Universal, and chased it away from people like Mo and Lenny and Howie, who I think, you know, really allowed artists to grow and do their thing. And lasting effects, I think it really was just one part of a cultural, one phase of an ongoing culture war that we still see rap music blamed today for. I mean, look at the Dunn case in Florida. You know, those poor kids, you know, all they're doing is they're playing loud teenage music. And because it's black teenage music, right, it gets demonized automatically. And so that war, that culture war, is still happening. And it's only because people resent the black voice. They just don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it. And they're going to hear it. You know, so the culture war will continue until it becomes manifest that that voice is not going away.
And I have to ask, you know, one sad thing in, you know, tragic moment in hip-hop's history, obviously it was the East Coast, West Coast beef.
Yeah.
But I've certainly thought this and seen bits and pieces of it, but I think you were the first person to talk about how there was disingenuousness on all sides of that.
Yeah.
That pretty much everyone liked the milieu because it was good for business. But at the same time, you know, if pressed, they'd say, oh, I want peace. I don't want this to, you know, you know, I think the example that comes to mind, of course, is, you know, something like releasing Who Shot You and then saying, oh, well, it was a record I just had laying around. It's not about anyone in particular.
Yeah, everybody played a role in that. I really do. I mean, I you know, I remember interviewing Danielle Smith, you know, about the Vibe years. And she asked me point blank, she's like, oh, is this going to be another, you know, blame Vibe, you know, because Russell did, you know, was very upset at Vibe. A lot of people were upset, you know, but Vibe was not the only source of that hypocrisy. I mean, DJs who played Who Shot Ya and then crying that Biggie's dead. Like, you know, you created this atmosphere. Everybody created it. And, you know, listen, my artist was involved in it. I mean, you know, Chino XL was so frustrated at not being heard. He just decided at some point that I'm just going to say exactly what I think poetically. And so his whole thing was these ill lines and punchlines. And one of the things he said was, by this industry, I'm trying not to get fucked like Tupac in jail. What he meant was Tupac's trying not to get fucked. But it was interpreted as Tupac's getting fucked in jail. So that led to this big feud between him and Pac, and that record Hit Him Up, which is the last record that Pac made before he, you know, was shot. And it was scary for us. It wasn't like we wanted that, you know. I think we had probably had to expect it with saying things like that. But at the same time, that stuff was really real. It was really real.
Yeah. So one or two quick final things.
Sure.
I was shocked to read in your book that the famous, like, Wu-Tang mailroom guy from Out of Nowhere story is actually true.
Yeah, which one is that? That's
he's playing the demo, and the guy comes who he'd never seen before comes out and is like, "That's amazing," and then disappears.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Steve Rifkin. If Steve Rifkin, you know, like wanted to give himself credit for it, he would. But I don't think Steve Rifkin's actually that kind of guy. I think
right.
He, you know, he said at that moment that dude ran in. That's my shit. That's a hip-hop story, because that's what it's all about. You want that. We care about the kid in the mailroom, from a kid who came from the mailroom myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, real quick, the C. Dolores Tucker, you know, famously led a crusade sort of against rap.
Yeah.
And I found it so interesting that you point out that, like, in part, I mean, you hint that in part her motivation was to get rid of years of bad press and shady behavior and sort of get rid of those associations around her name.
Everybody wants redemption.
Yeah. Did anyone point that out at the time, or did people just not know, or they were sort of too on the defensive to, you know,
I never heard it at the time. Vibe magazine, again, piece to Danielle, you know, because Vibe did reporting when nobody else was doing it. Vibe actually did surface a lot of that stuff. That she was, you know, a very controversial figure in Pennsylvania politics. She was outed as a slumlord. That she was fired from her job in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania for, you know, using her public office for private gain.
And in the last part of the book, you have some real insights into Rockefeller and the importance of Dame Dash, the rise of John Menealy and all this kind of stuff, who Jay has actually taken now to sort of have a larger public role and shouts out on records and all this kind of stuff that he wasn't doing in the early years. How did you get so much information on Rockefeller, especially when their biggest public face, Jay-Z, you know, is so tight-lipped publicly? I assume, first off, you didn't interview him, right?
I can't tell you.
Ah, all right.
I can't answer that question. I must protect the anonymity of my sources.
Wow.
Listen, there's some things that I think I got right, and then in retrospect, you're always finding things that, you know, maybe, like, my book came out right around the time that John Menealy was kind of demoted as well. Mm-hmm. So I think John Menealy's role was shifted after a time by Jay. So he became somewhat less important, I think. You know, he might be elevated again. I don't really keep too much of tabs on Rockefeller now. But it is an amazing story. And I did speak to Dame extensively. You know, Dame was talking at that point and had a lot to say and was, you know, I think pretty honest, you know, about himself and with himself. Part of this was to redeem Dame a little bit too. That Dame really did build those companies. Jay enjoys them now, and I think Jay has become a good business person, but it was Dame's passion that created them, and Dame had that same expansive horizontal vision. You know, I'm going to be the consumer products company. I'm not going to go try to get money from the consumer products company. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and in some ways, I think the book points out his sort of tragic flaw, which is the energy and vision and, you know, sheer force of personality that built the stuff up made him unable to sustain it once it had grown.
The thing I didn't talk about in the book that also may be true is the tragic flaw also might be untreated diabetes. I mean, it may be that this guy so aggravated his condition, you know, with alcohol and diet that he was prone to to blow up and to have these sort of episodes, the choleric episodes. You know, I'm not, again, not a medical doctor. Don't play one on TV, but I feel like, you know, Dame has, you know, spoken very publicly about his diabetes, and that it also, it's like, you know, health plays a role, mental health plays a role. All of these make us, you know, the human beings that we are, you know, not just, oh, Dame's an asshole. You know, right. Dame had some pretty big challenges and some pretty big heartbreaks. And, you know, I'm not saying that Jay owed him more than he owed him, but I do think we all owe Dame Dash some gratitude because he helped lay the blueprint of which Jay speaks. So,
yeah. And finally, what is Dan Charnas doing now? What are you working on?
Oh man, we in the lab. I mean, I am teaching currently at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music at NYU. Mm-hmm. Visiting faculty there.
It's a great program. I know some students.
And great students, great faculty, a great place to teach, a great place to think. And you know, I'm surrounded by great people like Jason King. And Nick Sansano and Jim Anderson and Bob Power, and I mean I could just go on. I mean,
wow, just Bob great. Power's in the faculty.
Yeah, man.
I didn't know that.
You get to walk into the office and say, "Bob Power, are you there?"
Which I would do once a day, I think, just on principle.
Yeah, I haven't even done. I haven't had the heart to do it. I've probably heard it so many times.
Right.
Hey, Bob. That's what Dan is doing, and being a good dad.
Wow. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming and talking to us.
Thank
and
you.
The Big Payback, phenomenal book on the history of hip-hop business. Thank you so much, Dan Charnas.
Thank you.
Back.
Thank you, Rap Genius.
All right.
Brooklyn.
That was our conversation with Dan Charnas. If you like what you hear on Outside the Lines, make sure to visit us at www.outsidethelinespodcast.com and find us on iTunes, where you can subscribe so that you never miss an episode. While you're there, make sure to give us a rating. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to have great guests like Dan Charnas.
Brooklyn.
Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I'm just going to say exactly what I think. Poetically.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
So he became somewhat less important, I think.
Our invaluable intern is Julia Hannafin.
She was, you know, a very controversial figure in Pennsylvania politics. She was outed as a slumlord.
And our music is by Psionic.
Wow, you know, thank God we have this dude helping to shape the narrative.
We'll see you in 2 weeks, Outside the Lines.
Cool. Yeah. So, thanks.
Are we
for
here? We're here. Okay.
All right. We're here. All right. Yeah.
Brooklyn.